you don't know what she's talking about, then it's time for Faith Finds Out. Ooh, you don't know, but you're gonna find out.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Faith Finds Out. This is your host, Faith Sines. I've had a real week over here, guys. I mean, not a bad one, necessarily. Just, it's been busy with a lot of work. Also, I have been just really down about the news of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passing. She's a hero. She's a hero for me and for so many other people. And, you know, it's unfortunate that there's so much around her death that is actually scary, because what losing her means politically for our nation right now is a frightful thing. And that's too bad, because I wish that I could just be sad and mourn the loss of a hero of mine instead of also fearing for my freedom. That is not something I wish I was piling on top of it. And I know that I'm being political and sharing opinion, and that's just where we're at right now. I'm all guards down, and I'm just telling you, I'm nervous about what this means. I'm hoping for the best. I'm hoping that they do what is right, which would be wait until we the people vote someone into office and allow that person that we the people vote into office to make a decision of who their nomination is going to be, who their nominee is going to be, I should say. That is what I hope happens. That is what is right. That is what we did when Obama was leaving office, and that is the only thing that makes fair, good sense. Obviously, been just feeling a lot of things this week. I think me immediately ranting has given you that indication fairly. I wanted to say also, and the reason that I'm saying this is I'm actually going to ask for help. I have been working, obviously, I have a full-time job that I do from home right now, obviously, because of the pandemic. I think we're all in that position. And I also am now working on this podcast, which is something that I love to do. It's so creatively fulfilling and just so fun. And also I'm working on building some other side hustles right now. And that's something that I'm really focused on doing as well. You know, I told myself that I wouldn't take on any projects that didn't feel creatively fulfilling and fun and enjoyable and genuinely worth my time. I don't love this concept of just trading time for money when you hate what you're doing with your time. Like, that just doesn't sound like any fun. But I say all that to say I've been working on a lot of different things, and I have found that it is incredibly hard to do these things when you are as unorganized with your time and just a straight up procrastinator like I am. I'm the worst of the worst procrastinators, and I always have been. And it's so stressful right now since I'm working on so many different things and juggling. It's so crazy. And I think sometimes, maybe this is like the Enneagram 5 in me, I don't know, but sometimes I get so overwhelmed with everything I have to do that I just do nothing. Like, this last weekend, I had the two-party system episode I was working on and some other things, like I said, for different projects. And I was so stressed out about what I had to do that I just laid on my couch all weekend and watched Netflix. And how was that helpful? It wasn't. And it caused a lot of trouble for me later in the week because I was rushing to get stuff done. It's just stupid. But I'm so bad at managing my time. And I'm finding that I just absolutely have to fix that, period. Like, I'm not going to be able to continue doing all of these things if I can't get my shit together in that sense. So if you are someone who has always worked from home, or maybe you've always been self-employed and had to be your own source of discipline, like, please, like, reach out to me and give me all your tips. I want all of your tips on how you, I understand how to effectively organize my time. My problem is following through. And if I write, like, for 1 hour, I'm going to do this one thing, like, I don't ever actually do that. And so it's like, I'm not holding myself accountable. How do I force myself to be more responsible with my time? I need tips, you guys. I really mean that. So DM me on Instagram, Faith Finds Out Podcast, and also just follow, because we have a lot of fun over there. I know I say that every week, but we really do. And then, or you can email me, faithfindsoutpodcast@gmail.com. Give me all your tips, guys. I really need them. This is like a serious request, because your girl is really not crushing it. She's not crushing it, guys. So, but back to Queen RBG, guys. I've had such a wonderful, lovely, but also very emotional time researching all about her life these past few days since hearing of her passing. For those who don't follow me on Instagram, I had a completely different episode planned for this week, and I'd been obviously already researching and outlining and all of that, and then when I heard that she had passed, it just didn't feel like I would have any kind of emotional connection to anything I was doing if it wasn't about her. So, changing course, gonna push that episode back to another time coming up soon, and instead we're gonna learn all about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg today, and we're gonna learn about her life, you know, how she grew up and how she met her husband and built her family and how she got interested in law in the first place and all of those awesome things. And then of course we'll go over all of her, you know, most, I guess, progressive and important cases that she worked on, even just as a very young lawyer, but we'll get into that. And then obviously becoming a judge and then a Supreme Court justice. So we'll get into all of it and just learn about her life. She is an incredible human being. She's incredible. And I'm excited. I'm excited to talk about her today, and I'm excited to hear from you guys after this episode goes live. I love getting messages from you about what you like and what your thoughts are. I love hearing your opinions on things. So definitely reach out to me if there's anything I didn't cover that you want to know about her, or if you just have thoughts and comments on what you learned today. So let's go ahead and do the fun fact super quick. I'm excited about this one, and then we'll go ahead and hop into the lesson. So, today's fun fact is Dr. Seuss actually wrote the famous children's book Green Eggs and Ham in order to win a bet against his publisher. The bet was that Dr. Seuss would not be able to write an entire book using only 50 words. I just love that so much. But what I love about it is it insinuates that he is such a genius and he is so good at what he did. Or does, did, right? He's so good at what he did, was so good that he had to challenge himself in stupid ways like this. Like he made a bet and he wrote a children's book because of it and based on it. And that's, I'm sure, was very challenging using only 50 unique words. And I love everything about that. Maybe I'm a book nerd, but I'm obsessed with Dr. Seuss, and he's such a mystery to me. I've never learned about him before. If you guys want a Dr. Seuss episode, let me know. Let me know if that sounds like a good idea. It might be fun to just dissect this guy's life. I don't know. I think that might be fun. I'm kind of interested. I'm writing that one down. Let me know if that sounds like a fun episode topic. But yeah, that's your fun fact today. It is the fun fact that I'll be sharing on the Instagram today. You guys get a new fun fact on Instagram every single day, though, so don't be bummed about that. You'll get new, unique fun facts starting tomorrow if you go listen now. And yeah, so let's go ahead, guys, and just take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll dive right into our lesson. And we are back, guys. So we're gonna hop right in. I got a lot of notes, a lot of things to cover. There's so much to talk about when it comes to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I am going to refer to her almost exclusively as RBG. The reason for that is A, it's a dope nickname. Deal with it. B, it's a lot to say Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg every single time, and this whole episode is all about her. So to help myself and also honor the, again, super dope nickname, I'm gonna call her RBG from now on. But we got a lot to cover all about her life. There's so much to talk about. I wanted to say really quickly before we hop in my resources. So I started off by watching, I actually had never watched the documentary that was made on her life. I believe it was in 2018, and I remember hearing all about it. It was big at the time, but I never watched it. So I went back and watched it. It's called RBG, and it's on Hulu for those who are on Hulu, and I believe Amazon Prime, you can rent it as well, but I know it's on Hulu available. So I started there. And what I do when I start with a documentary is I just have either my laptop with me or my notebook, and I'll just write down questions that I am pulling from the documentary. Like if they moved past something and didn't go into it, and I was like, but wait, I want to hear more about, you know, what that was like, I'll write that question down and I'll go dig for more information. I'll write down names and phrases of things I want to circle back to, and that's just kind of how it works. So then I went and filled in some of those gaps from, there's awesome, some information on history.com about her, of course, Wikipedia also, of course, and then just, I mean, really all over the map. I mean, you name it, CNN, like all over the place. There's definitely no lack of information about her, obviously, this week especially. So, but I wanted to call out my references ahead of time. And so, yeah, we'll hop right in. So, young RBG became the second female justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, which is incredible. And let's start all the way at the beginning and we'll talk about how she got there. So she was born in 1933 in Brooklyn, New York. Anyone who's born and raised in Brooklyn, don't you just already feel like they're a badass? Like they just come out of the womb like cursing at you, right? Like they come out of the womb and they're just like crying and like flipping you off. They're just bad, like in a good way. Like, they're formidable, let me say that. So she was a first-generation American on her dad's side. He is from Odessa in Russia, and she's a second-generation American on her mom's side. So of course, you know, given the time and everything, neither of her parents went to college, but her dad was incredibly passionate about his daughters getting an education. It was terribly, terribly important, and part of that came from the fact that he himself was deprived of education. You know, during his youth in Odessa, Jews, like himself, weren't admitted into Russian schools. So he learned the value of it because it was something he didn't have access to. And remember, I know that sounds like, duh, your parents want you to get an education, but that's not how things were at this time. The idea of passionately encouraging your daughters to pursue advanced education was not something that was necessarily super common. And most people at that time, the only reason they were really sending their daughters, and this is not conjecture, like this is how it was, the only reason they really encouraged their daughters to go to college was to find a husband. And so, you know, that typically is really the sole reason you send your daughter to college in that time. But her parents, both mother and father, were so passionate about them being wholly and completely educated and equipped to enter the workforce in any way that they chose and to work really hard for whatever it is that they believed in and wanted to devote their lives to. So really awesome foundation. Unfortunately, she had a sister who passed away when she was very young. So when RBG was only 14 months old, her older sister, who at the time was 6 years old, passed away due to meningitis. So she lost her only sister and only sibling in her youth. And then again, very unfortunately, her mother passed away when she was 17. She had cancer for a long time and she, you know, really lived through it and tried to get her children through high school, or her child, I should say, Ruth, through high school and just kind of see that all the way through. And unfortunately, the night before RBG's high school graduation was when her mom finally passed on. So tricky beginning, tricky origin, and in a tricky time to be a woman. The 1930s, she was born in the 1930s, like not an easy time to be a woman. And this was something that really drove her. And you, I mean, obviously we'll talk about it all throughout learning about her life. This was really a driving force for her, was all of the things that were stacked against her, I believe, is what really ignited this flame within her. So I wanted to make sure that we talk about that because I believe it's really important. Her mom always taught her, this is what she says in the documentary, her mom always taught her two main things. One, to be a lady, and two, to be independent. She, in the documentary, is quoted as saying, for her, a lady meant don't allow yourself to be overcome by useless emotions like anger. And by independent, she meant it would be fine if you met your Prince Charming, that would be great, but also always be able to take care of yourself, no matter what. I love that idea and that concept, and that's something that RBG really followed through with. Like, she really absolutely did become that. She had, you know, again, I'm getting ahead of myself because I'm excited, but she had a loving relationship with her husband, who was an awesome man who respected and honored her just as much as she did him. And they built a really strong foundation and a really beautiful family together. But at the same time, she was always so passionate about her own work, her own career, and making her own way. And the fact that they both supported that in one another is really such a wonderful thing. And again, such a rare thing to have found in that time. Actually, she says, of Marty, her husband, Marty Ginsburg, that she met when she was 17 and he was 18. They went to Cornell together. She said of him, he's the first man I ever met who cared that I had a brain. Most men in the 50s didn't. And that's such a wonderful, wonderful thing. We are obviously hopping ahead to college. She was 17 and he was 18 when they met. They met on a blind date, kind of. He actually knew what she looked like and who she was after the date was arranged, but she genuinely went into it blind, and they really hit it off kind of right away. So I love that. I'm going to give a lot of opinions throughout this, but I want to pause and say, she is such a hero of mine because of this full picture. It's not just because of the incredible work that she did and the laws that she challenged and changed and instituted and all of the incredible work. It's also because she pushed herself to live a full, fulfilling life that was not just work. She had passions and she had like a deep love for her husband and her children and her family in such a beautiful way. So I wanted to pause and just say, I love that. I love that so much. I want all of those things. So I really love seeing that. Quick note, I will say, all throughout her childhood, like her childhood best friends who were in the documentary and her college friends in the documentary always say the same few things about her. She was very smart. She was very quiet. And they said this, I swear to God, 4 or 5 times in the documentary, and it's online as well. She did not do small talk. Period. She wasn't interested in calling up her girlfriends and chatting about boys. She wasn't interested in talking about the weather. She was just not a small talk person, you know? She also was really pretty serious. And so that's something that her friends said about her, her childhood friends who call her Kiki for some reason. They said she had a quiet magnetism. She was smart, perceptive. She just didn't do small talk, which I love, frankly. I'm all about that. I hate it too. Who doesn't hate small talk at least a little bit? I don't know. Maybe some people don't, but I definitely do. So she met and got together with Marty in college. Marty was just a total opposite. He was a social butterfly. He was, you know, life of the party, super funny, and the dichotomy between them was really fascinating to those around them, but they all said, you know, it just worked. Like, she loved how loud and funny and active that Marty was, and he loved her quiet confidence and her intelligence and all of those things. She steadied him, and he, you know, made her life exciting, and it was a really good match, which is a really lovely thing. So she graduated from Cornell University in 1954. She finished first in her class. She then married Martin Ginsburg. So he was a year ahead of her. So at the time, he was a first-year law student when she graduated college. And then, you know, the early years of their marriage were really pretty challenging. Their first child, Jane, was born pretty shortly after Martin actually ended up being drafted into the military in that same year, 1954. He served for about 2 years. And after he was discharged, they returned to Harvard with Ginsburg also enrolling in law school. So she, I want you to just picture this. She had, when she entered law school, she had a 14-month-old baby on her hip, and her husband was away in the military. So that's a lot. I don't even know how you have the energy to enroll in something like law school, and to have all of that on top of it is really just something. And also, I believe, and I looked for confirmation on this everywhere, and it alludes to it but never outright says it, but I believe the reason that Marty was discharged is because of his cancer, because immediately after that, he is diagnosed with cancer for the first time, and pretty much in bed. So RBG, she did all of her studies, and then she coordinated with all of his friends to get notes and assignments and things for him so that he could keep up with his classes at the same time as obviously having her daughter with her full time. So she put everything aside to take care of her husband, because what else do you do? That's what you do, right? And, you know, it's beautiful the way she talked about that time in the documentary, because she was just like talking about how much she loved having her daughter as an escape from all the stuff that was going on. So she was like, you know, when I got home from school, until the time that my daughter went down to bed, it was all about my daughter. And it just was like that. Like, I was just playing with her and having fun with her and didn't want to think about anything else. And then I stayed up all night studying after she went to bed. But I really love that. Again, I'm gonna just be gushing about her this whole time, but what a woman. Just like, what a woman, right? So let's talk about her first year in law school. It's important that we talk specifically specifically about just what that was like for her. So when she first started in her first year at Harvard Law, there were 9 women in a class of over 500 men. So that is what it looked like. Women just didn't go into law. They just didn't. So, you know, 2% of her class was female. And she actually speaks about something called a dean's dinner for women. So the 9 women were invited to the dean's house for a formal dinner, and he asked everyone to go around the table, stand up, and explain what they were doing, taking a seat that could have been filled by a man. So obviously those kinds of things would be super illegal now, and RBG is one of the reasons why. She had this experience, and she took it in, and she recognized the injustice, and she devoted her life to it, and I think that's really incredible. You know, she obviously was a very hardworking student on top of everything she was juggling and dealing with, which we already talked about in her personal life. She also, in her second year, she was in the top 25 in her class. She was among the top 25 students in her class, again, of like 530, 540, around there. And she was one of only 2 females that made the law review. And that's a big, big accomplishment, major accomplishment. And again, especially being a woman in that time, to do something like that was notable. So then as Marty started to heal, he graduated law school and he got a job as a lawyer in New York City. So she actually transitioned to Columbia Law and ended up graduating from Columbia so that she could be with her husband and they could all be together as a family as he started his career as a tax lawyer. That was the kind of law he practiced. He was a tax lawyer in New York City. So when she graduated, she looked all over New York for a job and, you know, no one would hire her. No one would hire her. So she eventually did find work, but it was a real challenge and a real struggle. And again, all of this is just quietly building this fire within her. Of you can see all of these things that she faces and that she knows are very common things that all women everywhere in this time are facing, you know, all over the US. And she's just, she's taking it all in and she's making a game plan. And I love everything about that kind of determination and just refusal to be defeated, you know? She's formidable, guys. She is tiny but mighty. I forgot to tell you this, but one of my favorite things about her is that she is 5'1". She stands at 5'1" tall. That's so tiny! I'm only 5'2", so we're both really tiny, but I think that's why I love it so much. She is so small and so powerful. The more I gush. But anyway, so after graduation, she ended up clerking for U.S. District Judge Edmund L. Palmieri. I want to say Palmieri. She taught at Rutgers University Law School from 1963 until 1972, and then at Columbia from 1972 until 1980, when she became the school's first female tenured professor. So during the 70s, she also served as the director of the Women's Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. So this is where she made her name for herself, right? She really became known as someone you don't want to go up against. So let's talk a little bit about what some of the laws against women were in that time, just kind of set the stage for you. So just as some examples here, employees in most states could at the time legally fire women for being pregnant. Banks required women applying for credit to have their husband co-sign for them. In 12 states, this one makes me angry. In 12 states, husbands cannot be prosecuted for raping their wives. I want you to think about that last one. What does that mean? I'm sorry, because I know that this is about RBG, but let's talk about this. There are 12 states in which, at this time, husbands can't be prosecuted for raping their wives. Why do you think that is? Because in my opinion, that means that the lawmakers who created that law, that means that they view wives as husbands' property. Am I wrong? Like, she's yours. You own her. You can do whatever you want to her. Like, that's not illegal. And I want that to sit with you. I'm not even going to say any more about it. I want that to sit with you. But that is a little bit about what people in that time were facing. And obviously there was a big civil rights movement in the 1960s for Black Americans. And believe me, so many incredible civil rights leaders that we're going to get into and talk about. I'm already researching some and they're going to come up here in the next I would say month or two, and I'm very excited about that. But in the 60s, there was that big movement, and then in the 70s, very much based on that, very much because of that movement, the women in the 70s really just took the ball and ran with it. There was the big women's liberation movement that happened all through the 70s, and, you know, instead of marching, demonstrating, she decided she was going to fight these laws specifically, and she took on little case after little case, and her main goal was just a little bit here, a little bit there, move the needle forward a little bit more, and then a little bit more, and then a little bit more. And she very much recognized that she was teaching people as she was doing it. There were men, judges, lawyers, the Supreme Court at the time, all nine of them, of course, were men, who genuinely didn't understand that there was discrimination happening against women. Like, they genuinely just weren't even seeing clearly that there was a problem, because it's something that they never faced. If you never were oppressed, you don't pay much attention to the oppression, unfortunately. And so, you know, she understood. She didn't even get angry when they challenged her. She just understood, like, this is an educational opportunity. I'm teaching them what it's like to feel this and to live this experience and the injustice there. The first major one for her, there was this woman who was accepted into the Air Force, which, again, that in and of itself was new, that women could be in the Air Force. But she enrolled in the Air Force, and it was, you know, very quickly after that she recognized that all the men in her similar role, stature, I don't know how that works in the military, but they all got housing stipends and funding for their spouses, you know, as a benefit, as a part of their benefits package when they were employed by the Air Force. And she herself wasn't offered that and wasn't receiving that. So she assumed originally that it was just a mistake, and she went and asked the corporate office about it, and just basically the reception that she got was, you're lucky you're allowed to be a part of the Air Force. You're lucky that you get to serve the Air Force. We're lucky, you're lucky that we let you in here. So they straight up denied her these benefits and said, you're not going to get them. So, you know, she consulted with a lawyer, and the lawyer was like, this isn't an accident. This isn't something that we can resolve with a letter. This is a law that is allowing them to do this. So the only thing that we can do is sue. So RBG took on the case, and she took it all the way to the Supreme Court, and they won that case, which was a really incredible thing, and was the first sort of notable case. It was the first case she took before the Supreme Court. And then very shortly after that, something that was always thought of to be a very wise move for her is she took a man's case. There was a man named Steven Weinsfeld who unfortunately had a terrible thing happen. So his wife was in the hospital giving birth to their son, and unfortunately he lost her in labor. So she passed away. The son is alive and well, and so he obviously was a widower and a single parent home, and he all of a sudden had a newborn and wasn't able to work, and so there was a benefit available to widows at the time. It was a caregiver benefit, so that if one of the parents were to pass away, it was money to help support the other parent as they care for the child. So he went and tried to file for that, and they told him, no, that's the mother's benefit. That's only for if the man of the household passes away, because it was assumed that he was the money maker in the household. So he wrote a letter to a newspaper, and eventually that caught the attention of RBG, and she took on his case, which was incredibly smart. She sued for the benefit, for the right for men to have that benefit. It was ruled in her favor yet again that was a discriminatory law, and the Supreme Court agreed with her, and they won the case. You know, again, that is so smart, because she, and the way she put it in the documentary, is she wanted them to see that gender discrimination affects everyone. It does not only affect women. This kind of gender discrimination hurts even men, and there are a lot of ways that can happen. So, you know, she actually, Steven Weisenfeld himself was in the documentary, and he was telling the story of the day they took it to the Supreme Court, and he said, she had me come in and sit on the bench with her. She just wanted a man there to make, she said she wanted to make them feel more comfortable. So, I love that idea that she was, like, a little bit, it's almost a little shady. Like, she was almost kind of babying the Supreme Court. Like, I know they'll feel more comfortable if a man is present, so will you just stand there and look pretty? Thank you. And she just rolled up her sleeves and went to town, and I love everything about that. So anyway, she took little case after little case after little case. She took 6 cases to the Supreme Court for ruling, and she won 5 of those 6 cases. So all of this obviously continued to get her notoriety, and there were a lot of eyes on her at this time. And then in 1980, President Jimmy Carter appointed RBG to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. So he made her a judge for the D.C. Circuit, and she served there until she became a Supreme Court Justice, which we'll talk about. But she ruled as a judge in D.C. for 13 years. You know, really interesting to note here, and something that I really love again, is Marty, at the time, he had become one of the best tax lawyers in NYC when she was offered the judgeship in DC. So she said he just really recognized that the work she was doing was important, and he made the decision without even really wanting to discuss it further, that he was going to quit his job in New York and move with her and you know, just kind of turn the tables. Like, she spent so many years focusing on supporting him and his education and his career and his health, and he was like, the work she's doing right now is just really important, so it's my turn to take care of the home. And he did all the cooking. Apparently it was a joke in the house how bad of a cook she was, so he always did all the cooking for their 2 children. They have a son and a daughter, and we'll talk about that more later at the end. Her family she's survived by, but he took care of the home, and he let her do her thing during that time. He moved with her to DC, quit his job, and supported her career because he knew what she was doing was incredibly important. So I love everything about that. This really stupid, archaic idea that it is, like, somehow godly or biblical or something like that, that, like, women are in the home and men are, like, the leaders of the, I don't know, blah, blah, blah. It's just fun. It's fun to see people thrive in when they recognize that supporting and loving and respecting and honoring each other as equals is the most wonderful and beautiful kind of relationship. Anyway, I digress. So, so they moved to DC and she became a judge again for 13 years. And then in 1993, Bill Clinton selected her to fill the seat vacated by Justice Byron White. So she was nominated by Bill Clinton, and then she was confirmed by the Senate, and it was 96-3. So very easy win for her there. She became the court's, like I said, 2nd female justice that ever was, and she was the first Jewish female justice, which I love. You know, obviously the robes that the Supreme Court justices wear were designed for men, and they had, like, a big opening up at the top for their collar and tie and all of that. So she and Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, they decided together it would make sense for them to wear something that was designed for a woman to kind of fill in that gap there. So that's where the famous RBG collars come into play. Again, if you're someone who isn't familiar with her at all, I don't know how to explain this to you. You're just gonna have to Google it because it's very visual, but she has the most iconic collars with her justice robe. It is honestly my favorite thing on the planet, and she has a closet full of them, and people just send them to her, like, universities and things just gift them to her all the time. So she's out there really being a fashionista on top of everything else, which I just think is really incredible. So again, she's a badass in so many ways. So let's talk about her different landmark cases and decisions on the Supreme Court. So the very first one that I want to talk about is United States versus Virginia. There was a college, the Virginia Military Institute, that even all the way up till 1996, they were the last school in Virginia, I believe the last school in America, to not allow women. They did not admit women. It was a men's only college. There was a girl who sued for the right to enroll in that school, and, you know, they argued that it was unconstitutional for them to deny admission based on sex, and, you know, that was, you know, one of her first major cases on the Supreme Court, and they obviously held the decision that the Institute could not refuse to admit women. So I love that. I think that's so incredible. And you know what? It was really beautiful. I encourage you to watch this documentary, RBG, if you haven't already. It was really beautiful hearing from women who were in the first class of women after that decision, and just such a lovely representation of what her work was actively doing at the time. She was genuinely giving people opportunities for the first time that you know, prior to women had really never had. So it was just honestly, it's just really heartwarming, you know, to see so actively what all of her hard work was doing for all of us guys. So in 1999, she won the American Bar Institution's Thurgood Marshall Award for her contributions to gender equality and civil rights. Despite her reputation for restrained writing, she gathered considerable attention for her dissenting opinions. She became known for all of her dissents. So a dissent is when the Supreme Court makes a ruling. If someone on the Supreme Court didn't agree with the majority, they would file or a dissent, which was essentially like, I understand that this is the way the vote went, but I want you to know that I think this. And they kind of lay out their argument for the reason that they disagree. So she wrote a lot of now very famous dissents, but the most famous one probably was in the case of Bush versus Gore. So if you remember back to the 2000 presidential election, we remember all of the things about Florida and the hanging chad. If you don't Google it, I'm not going to get into it here, but it was one of the closest presidential races in our history as a nation. And it was just a really tense, crazy situation where, you know, the Supreme Court was having to rule on something that we as a country have never encountered before, period. So it was really, really crazy. And it ended up that the ruling was that they were not going to do a recount. And that meant that Bush won Florida, which meant that he won the election. So the Supreme Court's decision effectively instated Bush as president above Al Gore. So that was a big, big case, obviously, and she wrote a dissenting opinion that was very notable, a real game changer. She basically was very much not in favor of supporting that. She wanted to have a recount, and that was what she felt was fair and just. And so she, again, like I said, just eventually started becoming known for her dissents. She objected this, the reason that it was so famous is she objected in a way that was very deliberate, and the usual decorum of the Supreme Court is very important, right? The level of subtlety and, again, sophistication, professionalism that is upheld in the court is really important. And so there was a lot of like, I respectfully dissent. And she said, and this quote sounds like nothing, but when you're in law, apparently it's like the craziest thing, because everyone in the documentary responded like she had changed the world. But she just said, I dissent. Instead of saying respectfully, I dissent, she just said, hey, I don't agree, you jackass. I dissent. And that was a very famous moment in history for her. So, she continued to promote women's rights from the high court and just all up, I mean, up until the day that she passed. She continued to work and to go ahead at full speed. And, you know, there was another pretty major controversy that we'll kind of wrap up her controversies by talking about this. So during the 2016 presidential campaigns, she spoke out against Donald Trump and what a Donald Trump presidency would look like and administration. And it was very opinionated, and she got a lot of heat for it because, you know, a justice of the Supreme Court is supposed to rule with fairness, and that's the most important thing about what they do. So it is understandable that, you know, even as someone who is not a fan of Trump and very much agreed with her when she said all of those things in 2016, it's fair that that was something that, you know, she definitely was encouraged to apologize for. She issued an official apology. It's fair because it's really, really, really important that the justices on the Supreme Court that make up the Supreme Court are able to rule fairly, and that their political opinions are held very privately in terms of who they're voting for and supporting, right? So, you know, it just wasn't a thing that you do, and she got a lot of heat for it, and Trump had a lot of very candid things to say about her because he always does. He doesn't know any other way than just talking out of his ass. So, moving along, we need to talk about, unfortunately, the passing of her dear husband, Marty. In June of 2010, it was June 27th of 2010, he died from cancer. He did battle cancer in his youth, like we talked about, and it was ultimately what led to his death. They were married for 56 years. RBG loved the opera. And it's something that her whole family, her children and grandchildren, would go with her to festivals and things. She passionately loved the opera. She said that the human voice felt like an electrical current going through her. And she actually was in a few operas, obviously had speaking roles in a few operas, is highly respected in that world. She's like a super fan. She's one of those, you know how like there are celebrities who go to like every single Hamilton performance and they like hung out with all the cast backstage because they were just such major fans and they were important enough that they got to. She was that kind of a super fan for the opera, which I just love everything about that. I think that's adorable and so great. It's lovely for me, maybe this is personal, but I love hearing about important people talk about things outside of their career that they just love. Like, oh yeah, I'm also a big movie fan, or like whatever. I don't know why it fascinates me. I'm weird. But I wanted to say, you know, of her reputation, she was known as someone who could make friends across political parties, across really any difference in that, you know, separates her from another person. She just was so able to compartmentalize and be truly, truly very kind. She actually ended up, when she was a justice on the Supreme Court, she formed a very highly publicized, a very kind of popular friendship with Antonin Scalia, who is someone, he was just the political opposite of her, like super, super conservative Republican, like super conservative. I can't express that enough. But they became genuinely like best friends. They spent their free time together. They went to the operas together. They both loved the operas. There's this super famous picture of them riding on an elephant together somewhere in Asia. Like just this really very crazy, unique, unexpected friendship. And she was very much known for that in her personal life. All of her friends were like, yeah, she didn't really care about what you believed in. And she had a really great way of just putting that aside and building a relationship with people. You know, she never wanted to be known as someone who viciously fought for what she believed in. She just wanted to passionately fight for it, right? So I love everything about that. And it's again, it's wise and it's tactful. So look at what she's doing here, where she was never frustrated or angry that people weren't understanding. She just saw it as opportunities to teach. She was being the quiet, good girl that they wanted women to be at the same time as she was knocking all those doors down and all those roadblocks down. So she was able to be respected and listened to because the dumb thinking of men at that time, they weren't offended by her presence, right? She didn't make herself an offensive presence to sexist men. And because of that, she got in the room with them. She sat at the table with them and was able to make real change because she kept her cool mostly all the time, right? Which again is why the 2016 comments she made about Donald Trump were so, they were thought to be so wild because it was so unlike her to do, right? She's very serious and reserved. She always keeps her calm. So to make such bold statements like that was so out of the ordinary for her. But that really was such a key to her success. She played the game at the same time that she was changing the game. That's dope. Like, I don't care who you are, that's an incredible thing that she did. So, you know, I really focused in during this lesson on what she did for gender equality and to fight gender discrimination. And of course, that was, you know, something she was incredibly passionate about and definitely prioritized. But I do want to make sure that we talk about, just quickly, because I don't want to take up too much more time, I want to make sure that we talk about the other issues that she was involved in as a Supreme Court justice. She definitely deserves credit for the abortion rates that exist in our country today. You know, not going to stop and share opinions on this, but, you know, she was really passionate that, you know, the woman having the right to choose was a really very important human right. And so definitely many applaud her for the strides that she was able to make in that issue. She joined in the court's opinion, striking down Nebraska's partial birth abortion law in Steinberg versus Carhart. She was in the minority for the Gonzalez versus Carhart case, the decision upholding restrictions on partial birth abortion. So she, again, wrote a dissent about that, and she opposed the majority's decision to defer to legislative findings that the procedure was not safe for women. She focused a lot on the way that Congress reached its findings and definitely had opinions about that. She joined the majority for Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt. I want to say that Hellerstedt is the right way to say that, but that was a case which struck down parts of a 2013 Texas law regulating abortion providers. So she also authored a short concurring opinion which was even more critical of the legislation at issue. She asserted that the legislation was not aimed at protecting women's health, as Texas had said, but rather to impede upon women's access to abortions, which obviously many agree. Also, when it comes to search and seizure, she did not author the majority opinion. She was credited with influencing her colleagues on the case, though, of Safford Unified School District versus Reading, that the court ruled that a school went too far in ordering a 13-year-old female student to strip to her bra and underpants so female officials could search for drugs. Yeah, I'm gonna move past that one because it makes me very angry. In an interview published prior to the court's decision, Ginsburg shared her view that some of her colleagues did not fully appreciate the effect of a stripped search on a 13-year-old girl. She said they have never been a 13-year-old girl, and, you know, she got them there. So, the court ultimately agreed in an 8-1 decision, though, I'll say, that the school's search went too far and violated the Fourth Amendment and allowed the student's lawsuit against the school to go forward. And then in Herring versus United States in 2009, Ginsburg dissented from the court's decision not to suppress evidence due to a police officer's failure to update a computer system, in contrast to Roberts' emphasis on suppression as a means to deter police misconduct. So Ginsburg took a more robust view on the use of suppression as a remedy for a violation of defendants' Fourth Amendment rights. Ginsburg viewed suppression as a way to prevent the government from profiting from mistakes, and therefore as a remedy to preserve judicial integrity and respect civil rights. She rejected Roberts' assertion. Of course, when I say Roberts, I'm speaking of John Roberts, who's the Chief Justice of the United States. So she worked with and, I guess, beneath him on the Supreme Court. So, as I was saying, I realized I didn't explain to you who that was. But anyway, she also rejected Roberts' assertion that suppression would not deter mistakes, contending making police pay a higher price for mistakes would encourage them to take greater care. And, I mean, we all know how I feel about that one. So again, none of these defer too far away from, you know, the stuff she's most passionate about, which was gender discrimination. You know, I could go on and on about her life, but I want to keep it to, I think I want to keep it there. I think I want to wrap things up here. So, you know, if you haven't guessed already, she's someone who I admire very, very, very much and have always really looked up to. She is just an incredibly powerful woman. She is small and quiet and kind and unbelievably powerful. She is a formidable opponent, and I just love everything about that. After serving 27 years as a justice on the Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died on September 18th, 2020, due to complications from pancreatic cancer. She is survived by her two children, Jane Carol Ginsburg and James Stephen Ginsburg, and her four grandchildren, Paul Sparrow, Clara Sparrow, Miranda Ginsburg, Abigail Ginsburg. There's a quote I love so much, and I think I want to wrap up with it, from another, the Chief Justice, John G. Roberts Jr., who said, "Our nation has lost a jurist of historic stature. We at the Supreme Court have lost a cherished colleague. Today we mourn, but with confidence that future generations will remember Ruth Bader Ginsburg as we knew her, a tireless and resolute champion of justice." So, we're gonna wrap up here, guys. I want to say again, if you are feeling the things that I'm feeling right now, which is obviously sadness, but on top of that, fear, I would just encourage you, use that and make it mean something. First of all, if you haven't already, register to vote. I can't say enough how important it is. Everyone is saying it right now, so I'm not going to bore you with it, but it is the most important thing that we do as Americans is vote for the people who lead us, and it's never been more important than it is right now. And, you know, people who aren't political might hear this and roll their eyes and think it's dramatic, but I'm telling you that it isn't. We are fighting for our freedom at this point in time. We are fighting for these rights that Justice Bader Ginsburg fought so tirelessly for, they're up in the air right now in a way that I don't think people are quite understanding. The Trump administration is working to keep his power and strip us of our freedom. That's what we're looking at. Vote. Pay attention. Vote. Encourage your friends to vote. Encourage your family to vote. Make politics a conversation at the dinner table. I know that typically isn't something that people do. It's time to do that. This isn't something that we can be polite about anymore. And that doesn't mean be rude, but don't be quiet, right? Be loud right now and just know that it's really important and that your voice matters and your vote matters. Your vote matters. Doesn't matter who you are, what state you're in, if you are able to vote, your vote matters, and we need it. We need every last one. So let's continue honoring the wonderful people that have fought for our freedoms. Obviously, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is one of the most notable in the terms of the fight for gender equality, but there are so many incredible powerhouse forces who changed the course of history for so many different minorities. We can talk about incredible civil rights leaders that really fought so hard for Black Americans and their freedom. We can talk about so many pioneers in the LGBTQA community that fought tirelessly for rights to apply to them and to be treated like everyone else. And we have to honor what the work that they've done by not allowing that progress to be taken away. We can't allow our society to regress in that way. So vote. If you're still listening, if I did not lose you when I went on that last rant about voting, then thank you so much for tuning in. I will keep saying this, I am so moved by your support and those who are listening and sending me messages and commenting on episodes and things. It's really been just so fun and so incredible and so fulfilling. I love doing this. I am having so much fun, and I'm obviously growing into it, right? Like, there's going to be better episodes than others. I'm fumbling my way through this as an absolute beginner, but I'm grateful for you guys sticking with me, and there's nothing but better things to come. So, you know, we've got some really exciting topics coming up in the near future that I won't ruin for you at this time, but I'm really excited. Make sure that you subscribe if you haven't already. Subscribe, download the episodes, rate 5 stars in Apple Podcasts, you know, leave a review, and, you know, wherever you listen, subscribe. We also are now available on Amazon Music. So Amazon Music recently launched their podcast feature. They didn't have podcasts on Amazon before that. So we are now live. Faith Finds Out, you can find on Amazon Music, which is great. So thank you for your continued support. Please continue to share this podcast, pass it around, you know, ask your friends to listen if you're enjoying it and like what you're hearing. And, you know, again, follow me on Instagram, Faith Finds Out Podcast, email me, faithfindsoutpodcast@gmail.com. And thank you so much for everything. You guys are the best. I love you. I'm going to go hang out with my dogs and finish out this work day, but have an awesome rest of your week. And thank you so much again for listening to Faith Finds Out. This is Faith Signs Out.